Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you work all the rolling dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
I was made special note to not miss another appointment after hearing that list at the end of the last podcast of all the missed connections.
Oh, the missing connections.
Yeah. Trying to wrangle people is, I can't imagine it's easy.
Well, there are all kinds of variables, but there's this particular pattern that I mentioned in that outro is people who, and this was, you weren't, obviously.
Yeah.
I didn't ever get that sense from you, but
yeah.
People who seem to, I don't know what it is. I mean, get cold feet would be a charitable way of putting it, but it's a weird thing. It's people who are really enthusiastic or at least willing, and then suddenly nothing. Like.
Yeah, is that pattern specific to that situation? You know, have you had more thought about what it is that's triggering that?
I haven't. I mean, I've thought about thinking about it. I thought, okay, so I said that's a pattern. It must be a pattern. And what is that? Like a parental thing of somebody who says they're going to be there and then they're not. That's as far as I got. Like really basics 101 is like, oh, a parent that said they would be there and then they don't show up. I haven't dug any deeper into it.
And does that extend from just sort of the fellow sort of limitless autist experiencers and the sort of whatever professional people in the field? Is it just stronger in one or the other?
Both. Yeah, it's both. Okay. Although I would say with the liminal people, I mean, I'm not quite sure what that definition is, but I'm taking it kind of literally, or that distinction as people who are already aware of me and kind of drawn to what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Those types.
Yeah.
I think that that's more like cold feet. With the professional types, it seems like something else. Like they get offended by something, and I never know. I never find out what it is. It's quite mysterious.
Yeah.
I think possibly, I mean, to be logical about it, and it may not be logical, it may be really unconscious stuff moving around, but the logical answer would be, or the best one I came up with, is that they say yes and then they dig around a little bit and then they find something that they don't like. Like with Gordon White, I thought maybe because he's a fan of Chris Knowles, maybe he dug around and found out about that altercation with Knowles and then thought, to hell with this guy. I mean, that's just purely speculative.
Yeah. But Knowles is from Secret Son.
Yeah.
And there's something that went down between you and him?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. I missed that. I definitely catch all the podcasts and read some of the blogs, but definitely more of a audio listener. So I must have not noticed that one. Oh, okay.
It was pretty brief. It was around the Crucial Fictions when the website first went up, and I commented about it. I told Knowles about it at his blog, and he objected to the imagery of these children involved in some Russian experimentation. They're just wearing kind of bikini bottoms.
He
objected to the imagery and basically wanted me to take it down, and it kind of snowballed.
Wow. That's unfortunate. has he been on a podcast of yours, or?
He was on Stormy Weather. We did Stormy Weather together way back.
Yeah.
You were listening back in Stormy Weather days.
So. Yep. Yeah, I've definitely been tuned in since the beginning. It's always sad when you're away and great when you're back.
Right. So how did you first stumble upon what I was doing?
Yeah, it's a good question. It might have been through... I can't remember if it was... I think it might have been a guest that was on yours, or it might have been Neil Kramer, or... I'm trying to remember, but yeah, I got sort of brought over, and then just from maybe someone you interviewed that mentioned the interview, and then yeah, just sort of stayed stuck with it. How early was Kramer on?
Kramer was on Stormy Weather. I think it was number 19 as the final serve,
yeah.
So about halfway through the Stormy Weather run.
Yeah, somewhere. Yeah. That's probably about right.
Yeah, so I've there's only a very few. Well, I'm thinking, is it only one? Like Lavender, Kramer, there's a couple from Stormy Weather days that I've spoken to on the Limitless, and I don't think I'll speak to them again. I mean, we're not speaking to each other, but I just mean that I don't think I would invite them to do the thing again, for different reasons. But
did you talk to Kramer on Limitless?
Okay. Yeah.
Huh. Yeah. No, I thought your chats back with him on Stormy Weather were really sort of fruitful, interesting. But he's, he seems like a good guy. I don't want to talk negatively, but he's a bit more sort of on his book circuit now. So his interviews are not quite as interesting recently to me, at least. But
I found he's changed. He became much more formal, I guess. Try and think of a neutral term, but more controlled and more packaged. And if you listen to The Limitless, you will see why I
probably did
feel that probably we won't do a podcast again. Because I mean, it's not that it went badly, but he kind of did a disclaimer afterwards, saying that I didn't mean any of the stuff. I was just winding him up. So I don't know how I don't think he felt so great about it. And I mean, I was just bringing it up to illustrate how less and less affinity I feel for people in the alternate perceptions community who are putting forward a alternate interpretation. And I don't know how to put it into words. It's very difficult, but I call it platforming. I think of it as platforming people who are offering answers, really, rather than asking questions. And I think that happens it's very common that people who are seeking and studying and researching and then putting it out there, that they put together a kind of package, and then that becomes what they're doing, and that becomes their currency, and then they kind of stick with it, and so then they become the person who's providing answers rather than the person who is looking for answers. And that's just not interesting to me anymore, because then they come into a dialogue with a script, I find, and I did find that with Kramer.
And it also becomes their living, right? So, and part of it is that they're authoritative on something. So if they sort of present that position of not knowing, I think perhaps some of the financial possibilities go away. Because I'm sure he's a good guy, and it's hard to talk about other people and not sound like, I don't know.
I'm learning. I mean, I hope I'm learning the answer, because it's very difficult. Like with Jeffrey Kripal, who has been supportive of me. I mean, he's literally donated when I did the Limitless Patreon campaign. He made a donation. He's always been friendly in emails, but I don't feel that he's really been open to a dialogue or at all. The more that I've looked into his work, the more critical I am of it. And so trying to find ways to address that without it backfiring, in a sense, without it seeming mean-spirited I don't know. I mean, it's difficult to talk about from a meta level. But how do you criticize somebody who's doing what they're doing in the present, who's not dead, without it being personal? Because they're going to experience it as personal.
Yeah, but there has to be a way at the same time to just discuss things from a neutral perspective. This happened, and I felt that it was less interesting, but it's nothing, sort of.
Well, and also, if somebody is dissembling, you know, if they're putting out misinformation, even if they're unaware of it, or especially if they're unaware of it, maybe. I mean, I would want somebody to do that about what I'm doing. I don't take criticism very well, but I still, I really try hard not to shut it down.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about specifically, I don't know why, Neil. Not I think because I like him a lot, so that's why I have enjoyed very much listening to him over the years. So that, I guess that's why I thought about him. I just noticed over the years it changed. And what I actually thought about recently is that dichotomy between amateur and professional, and like the root of it being someone who does something for love and someone who does it for money, essentially. And it's interesting how it's sort of flipped now, where amateur sort of has a negative connotation, but I think that's what I enjoyed about it when he was just doing it. Yeah, still exploring it. Or, you know, anyone. This doesn't have to be about Neil, but when someone's doing it just from that earlier stage before it, like you said, coalesces into a platform, and they're just doing it because they're drawn to it. It seems to be more interesting.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, of course, there's a bit of a potential paradox in it. I always seem to end up in a paradox one way or another, but with liminalism, the idea is to stay amateurish, to stay in the place of not knowing. So, of course, if that becomes a position, I'm a liminalist and I know it, then you've lost it. But still, it's at least an attempt to kind of encourage that, or allow a space for that, the uncertainty. And that is there in the dialogues in the podcast generally. Like, I'm not, like the last podcast I did with Robin Eubanks, I found quite difficult to listen to because I really didn't know what I was doing. And that's fine when you're in with somebody else who's also willing to go into that space. But then it's very interesting, can be searching and groping. And I think it's uncomfortable to people. But that's fine. But in terms of me just being the guy who's interviewing, I mean, I think if I was ever much good at that, I've kind of lost what skills I had. Although people have said I give good interview, but they're not. It's not really interview. I mean, I really tend not to do the thing that interviewer does, which is kind of provide a platform for the person who wants to you know, sell their wares, really, one way or another.
That's interesting. So
but it's maybe a lost distinction between interview and dialogue, right? Because I mean, the platonic dialogues and whatnot were two people searching for the truth together, as opposed to one person asking another person, hey, what's true, you know, tell me.
Yeah, that's true. There's a bit of a return to that format now with podcasting and just it's an interesting distinction, though. But yeah, it's been interesting to see the evolution of just having other liminalists or experiencers or autists or whatever on. And yeah, it has been very entertaining. I certainly haven't noticed any, you know, drop in quality of the interviews with the more, I don't know, formal researchers, but
established people. There haven't been so many.
No, there haven't. And it's been amazing how interesting it is just listening to you talk with someone else. Like you said, it's, I think on paper it might not sound like something that would be valuable or interesting to a random third person, but yeah, it is. Have you gotten good feedback about the more informal ones?
Well, just what's out there on the podcast or the blog, really. I know there are people who say, well, I haven't listened to any podcasts because I've never heard any of the people. I've never heard of them, right?
Sure.
So there's that general expectation. You listen to a podcast because you want to hear what the guest, quote-unquote, has to say, because you're already familiar. And for a while I was working with that model, as in which names can I get to bring new listeners. Yeah. And I haven't thrown that out entirely. Yeah. But the notion that just two people having a conversation that neither of them know where it's going, which is the case with any real conversation anyway, that itself is a form of entertainment, and perhaps more than, but at least a form of entertainment. That's it's not really acknowledged, even though people who listen to podcasts, I think that's what they want, essentially.
Yeah, well, I assume that I'm not the only one that enjoys... Yeah, I guess, I mean, with a lot of programs, even TV, radio, we're all listening to things, and podcasts, I guess, we're mostly just listening, but I assume it's not just me that enjoys podcasts over other content because it's much more honest and genuine. So it's, yeah, this seems to be like a further evolution in that stuff in some ways. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose it's less packaged and less controlled, and then but then the tendency is, of course, to try and perfect
yeah.
it. What other podcasts do you listen to?
That's a good question, yeah. Well, Red Ice has obviously gone through a bit of a change. Was another one. I listened to the Joe Rogan Experience and some of the other people that have sprung out of that. Ari Shaffir, Duncan Trussell. I've listened to you since the beginning and sort of all the forms. I've listened to Jan Ervin's Gnostic Media stuff more in the past, but still tune in just to see what he's up to. I get sort of a dose of Second Matrix sort of entertainment from Higher Side Chats from time to time. It's like checking in with that Grimerica. Yeah, it's. I think those are the frequent ones.
Not WTF?
No, not really. I have listened a few times. Yeah, not one of my favorites. Do you listen to WTF much?
I've listened to a few, and that's in the way that I was saying other people don't listen to Limitless, as in if I'm interested in
yep.
the guest. And I'm kind of interested, because it's maybe the most popular podcast, I don't know if it really
yeah,
is or not, but
big.
Anyway,
yeah.
one of the Mark Maron style, and just kind of, I mean, it's the polar opposite to myself,
yeah.
really. I mean, he's just so extroverted, and so...
Yeah, he's very good at that.
Kind of... forceful personality, and he's constantly affirming the guest. I know it's like right, yeah, right. It's like a football coach
yeah.
or something.
I think that was one of the huge objections a lot of people had with the Obama interview that he did. It was sort of just a lot of because I guess throughout his career he's been quite critical of politics and sort of, and then Obama was on, he had sort of a great opportunity,
and
it
he didn't
mostly,
take it.
Yeah, just sort of got caught up and. Sort of, yeah. Just became a fanboy. But, yeah, let's see, Realm. Kunstler. It was awesome that you had Kunstler, that you guys cross-pollinated with James Kunstler. He's actually one of my favorite. So I think he's a really interesting one to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
I work in the as a landscape architect, so I enjoy his stuff. He's just an entertaining guy in general, but also his ideas on design and the built environment have been influential to me.
What's a landscape environment? Architect.
It's
sorry.
Like it's like an architect, but we do everything outside the building. So you do like town planning, or you know, design a new waterfront area for a city, or it's like all the public. It's more public space, transport, down to designing someone's you know backyard and pool area, all the way up to sort of doing plans and layouts for a region, like. You know, how is the transport network going to fit in this region? What are the environmental assets in this region? So, what you know, British Columbia or whatever, you could look at it, sort of landscape architects, look at it all the way up from a big macro view, sort of doing analysis down to planning what type of benches to put in on a new public street thoroughfare or something like that.
So how much say do you have then in what gets built?
Pretty decent amount, but it's so convoluted these days with the government and private interface, and it varies quite a bit from country to country. But as far as smaller details and fixtures, and let's put a shelter here of some sort, generally have quite a bit of ability to choose that stuff, but I'm pretty junior in that, and I just work at a company that mostly does residential landscape construction. So,
did you say junior?
Yeah, it's quite. I'm not that. I've only been practicing for a few years as a landscape architect, so I don't have a whole lot of authority.
Mm-hmm. Seems like it's a very high status job title, isn't it, architect?
Yes, it does carry sort of a bit of that. But I, you know, I chose to move out to quite a small town, and so it's, you're sort of limited to much more down to earth type work. There's some sort of positions with government bodies which would be a bit higher status, but sort of a glorified project manager and garden designer at this stage.
So one of the things that Kunst writes and talks about, if I'm not wrong, is the way in which architecture affects human consciousness.
Yeah. One of my favorite sort of things that he says is that we make physical built environments that aren't worth caring about, so people don't care about them. But he does touch on that quite a bit, and sort of the effect of suburbia on the human psyche and what that has caused.
Because it would also ripple down on how people feel about themselves and how they feel about each other, I imagine.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You're in some sort of public space devoid of any, like, beauty, and there's no order or coherence to it, you know, and no unifying art or sort of style. And there's no way that doesn't affect a human being when we're taking in all those things.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, anyone who's lived in a city for a long period of time and then gone into the country or moved to the country, well, maybe not anyone, but I certainly have noticed. I mean, every time that happens, I realize how much my environment affects me. And yet I wasn't aware of it when I was in the city. Because I wasn't, you just get used to it.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm going to start at the beginning, but I won't make it as long. Last night my baby said to me,
"You is dead, you is dead.
6 feet in the ground.
You is dead, you is dead.
You'll be always walking solo.
You is dead, you is dead.
I don't recognize your clothes.
You is dead, you is dead.
Now I can't feel no air around me. I don't know what I know. Only blackness lives before me.
You is dead, you is dead."
She screamed it to the four winds.
You is dead, you is dead.
Called my name on the floor.
You is dead, you is dead.
Sent her dogs to greet me.
You is dead, you is dead.
One said that you don't live no more.
You is dead, you is dead.
She had hunger in her face. Lightning sprang from her eyes. She'd been acting kinda crazy. This should come as no surprise.
You is dead, you is dead.
Ain't no prayers gonna save me.
You is dead, you is dead.
Ain't no doctors gonna come.
You is dead, you is dead.
And her gates is closed forever.
You is dead, you is dead.
And her monster beats its drummer.
You is dead, you is dead.
And she did not need a knife, and she did not need a gun. She just cast her gaze right through me. When it was done, it was done.
You is dead, you is dead. You is dead, you is dead.
So it might be fairly similar to me, but I spent most of my time in either small or large cities, and sort of made a choice to move out to a small town just because I'd sort of always romanticized it or considered it, and just sort of wanted to see what it's like. Was that your experience, that you're mostly a city person?
No, I'm a I'm not a city person, but I'm a a nomad is the phrase that comes to mind. But, you know, a go-with-the-flow sort of guy in that regard, in that I've always ended up living where where my trail ended, in a sense, as in I was just moving around, and then certain places would say, here, you stop here. So there was rarely, if ever, I want to live in this kind of environment, I'm going to find it thing. The closest would be living in London, because I could sign on to the Dole and get housing benefits. So when everything else failed, I would go back to London and, you know, get on the government teat and live a couple of years like that. But always I managed to swing it that I was in Hampstead, which is the most countrified part of London, also the most expensive, because there's a huge heath there, so it's like more trees per, you know, square foot than anywhere else in London. So there's all, I guess there always has been that awareness in me that I need to be to have a way out of the city, even if I'm in the city, kind of thing, not to get swallowed up. But in terms of living in a small town, I think, not counting Guatemalan towns where it's very different because the cult is, you know, completely foreign culture, I think that where I live now in British Columbia is probably the first time since I was a kid that I lived in a small town.
It's definitely been an interesting experience for me, moving from sort of a, what I guess, progressive in quotes city to just a small town, and just the different human culture. I've always been a hiker and a tramper and a lover of, you know, state parks and stuff, so it's not weird to be closer to nature, but it's really the difference in human culture and whatnot that's been quite striking for me personally. Challenging at times.
I mean, there's the question of community is what's come up for me. Now that I've got a thrift store, it's become experiential, but even before that, living in a town where there's 6,000 people tops, there is an awareness then of being part of the community in the way that one doesn't have, obviously, alone in the country or in a big city.
I certainly have realized that in those smaller communities you do have to be more diligent to not burn bridges, and that, you know, you come across back across the same people so frequently. But I think I've always struggled to get into a community, so it's been the same here or any city or country sort of hasn't changed yet. I think because the common denominator is myself and how I never feel like I fit in, or it's completely natural to do the things which will sort of engage you in communities.
Well, same, of course, but this is something that seems to have, well, there's a symbiotic relationship, I'd say, a chicken or an egg relationship between how alienated I feel in my own skin and how much I'm willing or able to participate in a community. So for me, starting to participate in a community has been, in the last few weeks really, has been an effect rather than the cause of becoming less, of becoming more at home in my skin, if that makes sense. As in, the more settled I've become in myself, in my body, in my psyche, the more that seems to have opened doors, so to speak, into the community. So now I can, it's like rubber meeting road, like, okay, now I'm able to experience myself as in my body, then the body is in the world, in the environment, and now I can actually put it into practice. So I'm okay with actually being in public, you know, all day, not all day, but every day, even though it is threatening to my constructed identity still, because my constructed identity is a negative identity, like everyone's, but my particular kind of negative identity is I'm not part of any community. and so on, you know, whatever, you know, fill in the gap, and I'm an alien, I'm an autist, I'm a super genius, whatever it is. I'm certainly not just some guy who says, hi, how are you? Have a nice day, come back, hope you come back anytime. You know, can I help you? Are you looking for anything in particular? A total nobody who's there just to serve others' needs and, of course, make money, serve my own needs too, but purely material. I mean, there's nothing highfalutin about it unless I want to turn it into something.
I mean, I guess that makes sense. It generally is always seems like changes need to start from the inside first, and then rather than you try to hang out with people or become embedded in community and then you feel more embodied or present in being a person, I think it makes logical sense that it goes from the bottom up. But I mean, even with that sort of intellectual knowledge, or even with the sense of if I, you know, I've got, you know, some pretty much my only close friends are from high school, and you know, they, whenever I, you know, talk to them or they visit, and it's great, and I say, oh, it's, you know, it's so nice hanging out with friends and having human contact and being a normal person. But then whenever I get opportunities with, you know, new random people here, it's like those activities, like, let's go down, you know, let's have a, you know, a beer at the pond. It's like, I can never bring myself to do those activities. Mm. Like, have you gotten that far where you're like, No,
I don't foresee that happening either.
I just can't do it, you know, even with the knowledge of, it's, you know, really nice hanging out with people and having friends, I still can't ever bring myself to do that type of activity. If that makes any sense,
Well, isn't it to do with that type of activity being a social convention that is relatively recent and that really doesn't have any purpose to it?
Yeah.
Does it? I mean, it's just how to get to know people so you feel... I mean, the only reason for us to get to know other people, unless we're going to take a spiritual perspective, but before we get to that, is to feel safe with them, to know that, you know, we can... They're not going to rip our throats out or rape our wives or eat our children kind of thing, you know? And that can be established, I don't know about relatively quickly, but certainly you don't... I mean...
You get a sense pretty quick, I think, whether someone's If
you're interacting with people within a work environment, you can find that out.
I guess
the thing is getting drunk together. That's a kind of acid test in vino veritas. If you can get drunk with someone, then you really know that you can trust them. There must be something like that about it.
Yeah.
It's entering into a liminal space.
Yeah, true.
But then the question is why? Unless you can ask them to babysit your kids or something, why do you really need to know that you can trust somebody that much? Because, I mean, I find working, I guess it depends on the kind of work, but working with people, as in customers in the thrift store, I have to get a sense of them if they keep coming back, and I have to draw boundaries sometimes. And the whole thing of bartering and all that, that's a very emotionally, psychologically charged area anyway. So there is a lot of natural kind of boundary evaluating and the sort of stuff that goes on at a primal level.
It's also it's also a liminal way to do retail because it's not a set price.
That's very true. And but a shop is also liminal in itself
because
people are just passing through.
And the product isn't always consistent, so that's changeable. You know what I mean? It's just whatever's passing through as well. So, Did you consider any of that before you got into thrift shopping, or did it just sort of...
It wasn't something
calculated.
That was, I mean, it was completely uncalculated in that the opportunity came up and we said, okay, let's do it. But even between the opportunity and okay, let's do it, there wasn't any kind of, there wasn't much thought about it. It was just like, oh, okay, well, that I'm sure that'll work.
Mm-hmm.
So our only question was, you know, would it work financially?
Yeah.
There was, certainly wasn't, let's check. You know, well, actually, I think my wife probably did do an astro reading, but it wasn't about is this psychologically right for us or anything. It was just about is this likely to succeed as a business.
Yeah, practically.
So I think that's it's kind of back to the same point, really, is if we pay attention to attend to sufficiently the practical questions, the other, the subtler things, they. they're taking care of themselves anyway. It's, mm-hmm. I mean, I've said this for years, really, one way or another. We just need to take care of our physical, our physical needs, and the spiritual process is always underway.
Yeah, that's true. That's interesting because it's, you know, I've been trying, you know, toying with being healthy and looking at sort of the different things that go into that physically, and I guess it makes sense that the same pattern would apply on a sort of to the psyche as well. But because to be more specific, you see a lot of times people that want to get healthy, they'll start doing exercise first, and or they'll start eating diet. And I just, if my personally, I noticed that like both those things were not really effective if your sleep was off. And then so I started imagining in my head this like pyramid, and there's no sense in like building the upper levels until the larger base ones are ready. And it seems that exercise is sort of the like last, you know, peak to to sort of optimizing that, you know. And I guess
Well, I was thinking that when I said the thing I said, which is that if it's overly literalized in terms of what's physical, then no, that's that's not what I mean by attending to the physical. I mean, I'm not sure what I mean because it's instinctive. Okay. The physical itself has, but for example, and I don't do this, so it's perhaps not the best example, but some people can determine, well, actually, I'll give an example that at least something happened recently. A woman yesterday came into the shop and we've got all these high heel shoes, and she said, I think it was, it was a witch woman. She wears a pentangle on her finger. She said, I can just look at shoes now, and if my feet hurt, then I know that I'm not going to buy them. So there's a way to tune into the body's signals about, you know, basically everything that we're doing to let us know if this is practically right for us, if this is practical, if these shoes are practical, if this food is practical, if this... Skype conversation is practical. If this art design, you know, even when I'm doing artwork, there's a kind of click. Artists talk about the click, right? It's physical. You just know, okay, that it's done now. Well, this is the right word, and that wasn't the right word. It's you know, I have a question on that horticulture thing, which is how you contacted me. What's your sense of right and wrong? Is it physical? Is it intuitive? Is it intellectual? Is it non-existent? I can't remember all the options, but I know physical is one of them. Well, it would be visceral or physical. It might be one or the other. And so that, I mean, my sense of right and wrong, the sense that I trust in anyway, is a visceral one. It's not a mental or an intuitive one. Although intuitive, that's blurry about intuitive, because I think intuition is visceral too, actually.
Yeah, that is always a tricky one when there's a division made sort of between, like, some people divide, like, visceral gut or emotional heart, you know what I mean? And they're separated. And I was trying to think, can I tell the difference? Are they, you know, it's like a fine, hazy line, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, well, because it's the mind, probably it's the mind that's making those arbitrary distinctions to begin with. Certainly if we think about synesthesia and infant perceptual experience of affect, where it's just all the sensory data is just going straight into the body as like one block of information. Before we have a mind identity that's passing it all out.
Which seems much more like how you experience things on large doses of psychedelics. Was that...
How I do?
Yeah.
Or how do you do?
I mean, that's... You just sort of experience without any filtering, like a big overloading wash of everything. Which is, from my experience, quite a pleasurable way to experience things.
On psychedelics?
Well, just in that fashion. I mean, it doesn't... I'm not wedded to it being induced by that, but
I wouldn't say my psychedelic experiences were pleasant. I mean, there were some of it aspects were, but generally they were, you know, the most positive and the ones that I would stand behind also and say that was worthwhile doing. They were just super intense, so pleasant. They weren't necessarily pleasant.
Okay. Really?
They might have been. euphoric or ecstatic.
Okay, yeah.
But that's another extreme. So, I mean, I have like my sense of what's pleasant or what pleasure is, and mm-hmm. back to this visceral sense of being a body or being in a body, is that it's the subtler it is, the deeper it is, the more richly pleasant it is, but also the harder to even notice. So as opposed to a psychedelic experience where you just basically the doors of your perception are blown off their hinges and you're like, I am the universe, yeah. I am God. I mean, the massive ego inflation I had during and after those experiences, because they were just so cosmic in nature. Whereas the experiences that I have now, you know, post psychedelic, where I feel I've maybe more or less regenerated the cells that were destroyed and deflated the ego that was inflated, etc. And now wouldn't even be in the same room as someone who's smoking marijuana, you know, don't even want to inhale it secondhand. There's a sensation that I'm aware of now sometimes, which is kind of like it's like the body folding in on itself. I don't know how to describe it, but it's like consciousness is enfolded into matter in some way, and the body is this fold.
Yep.
And it's incredibly, incredibly sweet, and it's just really, really, really very, very subtle, but also quite familiar. So it seems as though, that sensation, there's an opportunity to go deeper and deeper into that, and I mean, all the way into that fold, I guess. I'm really talking about something I've never talked about before.
Yeah.
But
This is pleasant, though, you're saying. A pleasant...
This is what I would say is pleasure. And I think, you know, psychedelics and sex being more obvious examples, we want a strong sensation to feel something that actually in its... truest experience of it isn't strong.
It's
incredibly subtle, but that's actually the value of it somehow, is that it's I guess that it's too subtle for us to do that thing, you know, make a profession out of it, make a philosophy out of it, to put a handle and a price tag on it.
Yeah. It is so subtle that it would be completely lost in that process.
Yeah, you can't. I don't think. Sorry, then. No, you can't teach it, and you can't describe it, and you can't conceptualize it. I mean, I just foolishly sort of tried to, but only because I wanted to communicate to you.
Yeah,
like maybe you had something vaguely similar.
Well, interestingly, it reminds me of experience almost the opposite, that like the outfolding of awareness or consciousness from the body, which I experienced once while trying to go to sleep on a large dose of psychedelic mushrooms. And it was incredibly unpleasant's not quite the right word, but startling. This place where normally the conscious mind, I think, was asleep, they were still an observer, and this process of like an unfolding or a pulling out of the consciousness or the mind from the body. And as soon as you started describing the infolding, it reminded me of this sort of outfolding or removal process that I observed once that was sort of subtly unpleasant or subtly disturbing, I guess. Disturbing is probably the better word for it, because something that's not usually observed, but sleep is such a strange and mysterious process. It wasn't surprising to me that observing some mechanic of it or thinking that you were was a bit disturbing.
I think there's a whole host of sensations that we can have as consciousness that don't translate into bodily sensations. So this one I described is really that. It's in the body, but it's not a bodily, because it's not, I couldn't tell if it was hard or soft or warm or cold or where it was in the body. It wasn't really a bodily sensation. It was more like the sensation of consciousness in a body.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. And I remember as a, I sort of remember as a kid, and I think this is quite common for children, young people, to having dreams of indescribable sensations. Like you dream that you're a triangle or something. I'm just using a random example. It wasn't that, but experiences that were sensory but were not they didn't correlate with the mind or even the body. They just seemed like and if we try to imagine, you know, what would it be like as consciousness, what will it be like when the body falls away? And I mentioned this on the blog just a couple of days ago, like somebody with Kutaman was talking about the interiority and putting our attention on the interior space in the body, which I talk about a lot. And I really do feel that's where I am, that's where that infinite space within. But that is contained by the body, so that's how I locate it, right? It's on the other side of my skin, you know, the world begins on the outside of my skin, and then on the other side there's this interior space which is me, which is the container for my consciousness. So what happens when the container falls away? Like what becomes of consciousness then?
Yeah,
obviously this is a very crucial question.
Yes.
For those of us who wonder, you know, and yeah. know that someday we're going to find out and kind of want to be prepared, I suppose. I mean, I don't know if it's actually reasonable to think that one can be, but there's an inevitable desire.
Good to be prepared.
Well, that's what I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't, but it's inevitable that we're going to want that because it feels frightening without it.
Yeah.
I had a dream recently that I died, and it was a sensation. Like I died into this sensation, and it was absolutely amazing. It was a very positive experience. This incredible sensation. I don't know if it was just one sensation, it was limited, but just that I was dying into this sensory world that was really great, you know, like ecstatic. And I don't have words for it. But that's just one of many dreams I've had. I've also had nightmares about being without a body, and it seems logical, it's a mental level, of course, but that there's an almost infinite spectrum of experiences that we might have as consciousness without a body.
Yeah.
Oh, my mate, he don't like kissing. Now what do I do? It's restless after just a minute or two. He says he has to go fix a record or polish his boots. And I live lonely, pull up on
trying to sort of intellectualize these topics is fun and I think fruitful, but so tricky because then there's the whole idea of even the sort of perception of linear time and that whether or not that's actually a thing or how that's perceived post body or it would change dramatically that experience, right? Like if there was just an it's much more traumatic to lose something if you're like, you know, go in this linear sense where you don't see what's in front of that, you know what I mean? And it's I guess it's hard to tell how our experience of time would be without a body.
Yeah, without a heartbeat.
Yeah.
Mark time.
Yeah, without anything. And whether or not, yeah, there's the body's a container or an anchor or, you know, something between or, you know, I guess almost always it's something in the, gray zone.
From the depths.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I was thinking about the time just the other day. recently, and about Saturn, you know, Saturn being the Lord of Time, archetypally, and how it seemed like there was a correlation between that. Why Saturn also rules depression, because the thing that haunts me and that depresses me, I guess, when I still feel oppressed by this awareness, anyway, is the linearity of time. Like when I think about it has to do with routine, so I do things on a daily basis and I enjoy them, but the fact that I'm just going to keep doing them over and over again somehow distresses and depresses me. And then of course, presumably, I imagine that's also because that leads me to the awareness that there will be a final time, every line has an ending, every sentence has a full stop, and that's depressing, right? Being finite, although being infinite might be even worse, but you know, there is something oppressive simply about time, I think.
Yeah, well, that is interesting sort of gray area you've brought up on that, because I think a lot of us who don't love what they have to do for work, and that's a commonly shared not enjoyable routine where you do it and you're like, oh, that sort of sucked. But then the worst part is that you know for the foreseeable future you'll just do this same unfulfilling pattern. But it's interesting that you threw in the little thing that it's depressing because it's actually nice to do something, and that somewhere you realize that you'd rather be doing this seemingly depressing routine than no routine.
Just to be here. And so, for me, it's I don't have a depressing routine. I don't have to do anything I don't want to.
Yeah.
I almost never have, really.
It's pretty nice.
Well, yeah, but I think it's been a choice thing.
Sure.
I chose to be homeless on the street, tiger in Africa and stuff. So, of course, I didn't want to be hungry and have my life endangered every day. And it was horrible, but I did choose it. So then, so whereas somebody who chooses to be a wage slave, well, I don't think they do choose that. I mean, I'm not saying that I'm so different. I mean, all our choices are unconscious anyway, and so I was programmed with whatever it was in me. But still, it is a contrast. You put it, I can say I've pretty much never done anything I didn't want to do, except I suffered, of course. I suffered, you know. I didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
But in terms of a routine, I only had a day job once, and it was fine. It was when I first discovered the internet, and it was in the early days. So I spent the whole time just doing internet.
Oh, that sounds
so bad. I've never been in that situation where the actual routine I was in was itself, restricting. It's just that any routine has felt that way to me.
Yeah.
It feels futile. It just feels futile to do the same thing over and over again and then die, right?
Yeah, definitely. Well, there's no novelty in it or no mystery. And I think, it makes sense. Definitely. The whole sort of Alan Watts idea of being a god, and that's sort of boring unless you don't know what's going to happen. So you put yourself into that situation of not
being a god, did you say?
Yeah.
Forgetting what we are?
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of Strieber-esque. I think he wrote that about the visitors.
Did he?
They were conscious of eternity, and that they were paralyzed by that, prisoners of infinity. So they had to find a way to exist where there was still the possibility of surprise.
Huh. Oh wow, that's exactly sort of what Watts lays out in one of his famous. It's a YouTube clip called "Inception." It's a snippet of a bigger Alan Watts talk, but it's almost exactly that.
I think it's a mental conceit, though. I mean, did you listen to Venetia on the recent Limitless?
Yes, yeah, I've listened to them all. Yeah,
because she talked about how she experienced. I think it was in Athens. She went into a temple and she realized, in quotes, that she'd always been there.
Yeah,
and it's at a mental level. She said it was depressing. Oh my God, I'm still here, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So there's something about when the mind, and I've had much more intense experience on psychedelics in which I felt utterly damned. I wrote about it in Homo Serpens. I went from experiencing what seemed like ultimate consciousness, really, experiencing myself as eternal, while also aware that I was in a body that was going to die just moments. The time was running out blindingly fast for the body, but the consciousness I was eternal. And then what happened was that what appeared to happen anyway was that from this eternal consciousness, I kind of referred it to my physical life, and because I was God or whatever, infinite consciousness, I thought, well, I can do anything. I'm God, I'm it, I'm everything. Oh, that means I can fuck this girl that I've always wanted to fuck. It was basically just I could just couldn't get it right with her anyway. And as soon as I had that thought, I felt that consciousness as whatever it was, the infinite eternal, pulling away from me, saying, you've lost this now. And then I went from that bliss of eternal awareness to this horrendous state where everywhere I looked and every thought I had led to experience of being damned. So basically it was like every moment there was this opportunity that was arising, and if I missed the opportunity, I was going to be damned. And so I would experience, I'm about to be damned, and then I just get pulled back to, I escaped damnation, and then the next millisecond, another. I'm about to be damned, and each time and I actually ended in real action terms. Because I was wandering around my house in this state of whatever I was going to say, moral horror. That's from Apocalypse Now, but anyway, what do I do? Oh my God! And I just acting, automatically, really, just trying to escape this feeling. And I ended up going up the stairs into my bedroom where there's a terrace. And as I was going up the stairs, I was thinking, I've got no reason to go up the stairs. I'm going to be damned for all eternity for this because it's the wrong thing to do. So then when I got to my room, I went to the terrace and I leapt off the terrace because that was the only way I could justify having gone up the stairs. And I could have, broken my ankle, on story. But that was it. Phew, I managed to escape damnation, one more time kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting in terms of you can see how people get driven into this really insane behavior if their consciousness is in this state where so much seems at stake. And it's up to them, the choices that they make. I didn't go out and kill anyone, but it felt like I would have done anything to escape that prison of infinity or whatever it was that happens when, or happened to me anyway, when the mind gets introduced to eternity somehow. The mind structure stays intact, but it's witnessing eternity.
We're talking about time. Was there any sort of, was it the finiteness of time, was there any connection to the feeling of damnation with time?
There was the sense of eternity. I mean, damnation it wasn't going to be just for tonight. That was part of it. Yeah. This is
forever in this state.
Yeah, and it was, and each, but each moment was like, a taste of it, really. Each moment was like, this is eternal damnation if you want it, or if you, it wasn't really if you want it, but
yeah,
if you keep on this path, or, I mean, again, it's easy to see how these, you know, Christian and religious doctrines, where they emerged from.
Yeah.
When we try to encapsulate experiences of the numinous into some sort of mental framework.
Yeah, sort of, I don't know why, but it reminds me of, like, have you ever read any of C.S. Lewis's, like, philosophy stuff?
No, I don't think so. I read the sci-fi stories, the ones I'm most familiar with.
Yeah, those are quite trippy books.
Yeah.
No, he just sort of, it seems like his conception of hell was just this weird, it was just a very, how do you describe it? It was just basically people moved on and they kept making the same, they sort of continued on the same patterns and choices. And it was completely, they basically had the ability to do whatever they want for it to be heaven or hell or anything, but they just sort of continued these sort of toxic choices that they were making in their life, and they just kept on going forever, and they kept getting annoyed with people. And in his scenario, it's much more grounded, so they're like, I don't know, you died and you dropped off by a bus or whatever, and you can sort of manifest anything you want. I think these people make a house, and, you know, and then they're like, get annoyed by a neighbor that's close, and they move further away, and people, you know, they're just grumpy people, and they keep moving further and further away until they're just like completely isolated, you know, infinitely far from everyone, and just alone in this like desolate void that they've sort of created for themselves by choice. And a few people that escape that, I guess, see that pattern, they go someplace else. But yeah,
right, so that's like the constructed identity that and the negative identity that can really can only exist as a closed system. That's why Zanora and I were circling around that a bit with the ceremony, the Buddhist ceremony of opening up to the demons and letting all the demons devour you. That would be interesting, because that would be the Christian idea of hell, of course, to do that.
Yeah.
And that's an image of hell, and yet that would seem to be the path of psychic integration, is to let the demons devour you, because the demons are all those neighbors that you basically can't stand to live with, right? The parts of ourselves that we sectioned off because they were unacceptable to us.
Yeah. Well, I interestingly had pretty similar experience, you know, obviously before hearing the Zanora interview. As a kid, I remember just trying to just do basic meditation, just, you know, breathing in and out and counting it, just real basic stuff. But then getting this sense of all these sort of just a writhing swarm of demons, not quite right, but weird, freaky things, just swarming and sort of seething around me as I did this. And then later had an interesting, very, very high dose mushroom experience, where I was in constant dialogue with some sort of voice, and was sort of explaining, oh yeah, well, you know, as a young sort of person, there's a lot of energy being put off and things feed on it, and, you know, this was somehow connected to what we were discussing. But And that carried on later to more experiences where I'd sort of get the feeling of, okay, well, that's right. Well, I learned those are demons. And I'd feel, on large doses of psychedelics, I'd feel these sort of attachments or points. And I thought, okay, well, maybe they're vampiring, you know, my sort of essence or my energy. Mm-hmm. And then you get it, and I got in this weird thing. Well, you know, do I need to accept that that's a state? You know, do you need to fight it? Or is it just accepting, yes, that's there? Or, you know, it's this weird thing of, you know, if I perceive that as being something negative, then is it? And then they become sort of vampiric. But if you just accept that there's some sort of ecosystem where this happens, and then that sort of perception of it not being demonic or toxic transforms it into more symbiotic.
Mm-hmm. So did you reach a conclusion?
I think ultimately I lean towards the acceptance of of that thing happening at that moment either way, and so that the sort of resisting or fighting it wasn't helpful was sort of the conclusion I came to, whether or not it was demonic or not. And then it seemed less toxic, but no, nothing sort of still, if I had to choose, would, you know, not sure either way. If that is a real thing, I'm not sure what's the proper way to sort of resist that and try and clear yourself or cleanse yourself or just embrace that occurrence.
It seemed like it wouldn't be an entirely rational process anyway if we're talking about something that is invading one's psyche. There's a very visceral reaction to that, a fight or flight kind of response.
Yeah, definitely. During a mushroom trip where I was communicating with some voice, there was a very clear sort of framework laid out that, you know, just, you know, they said, this voice said, oh, you know, just like you see on Earth that there's an ecology of life, of biological life, there's ecologies of different types of life that, you know, instead of living on carbon and sunlight, they live on something that consciousness produces, and human beings produce a large amount of it. And they said, you know, just like in the physical biome, you could have a very healthy symbiotic system where you have a large oak tree and it sort of drops its acorns naturally, and there's some cute animal lives under it and eats it, and it takes a shit and that fertilizes it. Or you can have sort of like broken down vampiric parasitic relationships, so that sort of only made it more confusing to, okay, what do I need to cultivate, you know, the actions cultivate a positive sort of psychic ecosystem around me, or, you know.
That's the end of the first part of my chat with Aaron. Part two will be up next Wednesday, May the 4th. I would like to thank donators for the last couple of weeks. It's Mark, Chris, Anne, Elizabeth, Andy, Patricia. And Anne again. I think Anne twice and then a third time today in person, because I got to meet Anne Diamond in person today, kind of unexpectedly, and did a podcast together which will be up in, I guess, 3 weeks. Next week, podcast is with Jason Wilcox again, and a week after that with the listener Isaac, and then my conversation with Anne. I'd also like to thank those listeners who did respond to my plaintive plea to review Seen and Not Seen. I think there's been 3 extra reviews since I put that out there. So that was very nice, very gratifying. They're all 5-star reviews, so that doesn't hurt either, but because don't feel that you have to. Anyway, keep them coming. If you have read the book, every little bit helps. I have an upcoming gig, which I won't talk about now, except to say that it's going to be another podcast that I'm doing as part of another website, which is more academically oriented. And so keep an ear out for that. It's going to be an interesting challenge for me. And for those of you who feel you can't get enough of my voice, well, you're prayers are answered, because there's going to be still more of it, God willing. It's been a very rough week. You will find out how and why of that if you continue listening to this podcast. For now, that's all I have to say. Thanks for listening as always, and until next time, this is your liminal acquaintance, Jason Horsley, horticulture.com.
chicks, a shiny new bus with a crazy ride, 'cause everybody's partying inside them to Romeo. Smack dab in the middle, pitch me a smack dab in the middle, throw me smack dab in the middle, and let me rock and roll to satisfy my son.
Satisfy my soul.
Right down in the middle.
Satisfy my soul.